Hello, and welcome to the July 2nd through 9th edition of the American Magazine podcast. This is Tim Reedy, online editor of America, and this week we'll be talking to Terry Galway, columnist for America and professor of U.S. history at Kane University. And we'll also have a reading of Father Dennis Lenihan's Of Many Things column. This is Tim Reedy, online editor of America Magazine. We're here this week with Terry Galway, columnist for the magazine. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Tim.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, Terry, how long have you been writing for America?
Since 7 BC. Well, actually, it doesn't seem that long, but I think since 1995, it could be 1996, but certainly in the mid-90s, can we leave it at that?
Okay. And you were hired by Father George Hunt.
I was, yes, and I've remained a very good friend of Father Hunt. I think he did a fabulous job with the magazine, and it has been a real pleasure to see the way the magazine has grown through the years, and of course now it's in the 21st century in every way possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were first given the column, were you assigned to write about certain subjects, or...
Well, I think Father Hunt envisioned the idea that there needed to be more of a lay voice in the magazine. So I was actually one of several columnists he brought on. I've just managed to hang around longer than any of the others. But there were a few others who are no longer with the magazine. But the idea was to sort of get a voice from the pews.
Mm-hmm. And you've written about issue politics, but also cultural issues. I mean, it's... Your training is a journalist, correct?
Yes, yeah. Yes. My training is a journalist, and I've sort of brought that approach. In fact, that one of the funnier letters I've received through the years was from a woman who said, "I want you to know that, you know, the first thing I read in America is your column." I suppose that doesn't make me an intellectual, but it's how I am.
Interesting.
It could be a compliment, but maybe not.
Now, originally your column was called Life in the 90s, right?
Yes, yes. We decided to change that, however, when Life in the 90s was so 90s.
Now, how do you, Life in the aughts, the audi-aughts, how do you say
that? That title was the work of Father Bob Collins, okay. Who's been my editor for 15 years, a wonderful guy, and he came up with that title, and who was I to disagree with Father Collins?
I know where you're coming from there. So now you had been working at the New York Observer. Right, as an editor. And how many years were you there?
Yes, I started at the New York Observer even before I started at America in 1990. I still am connected to the newspaper in some ways. I write the occasional editorial. The people at the Observer, it was the best journalistic job I ever had, because other than my gig at the America magazine. but they're similar in the sense that no one has ever told me what to write and what not to write.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get wonderful feedback from editors, but it is really hard to find a job in journalism today where you can say, you know what, there is no editorial control in the sense that no one is telling you what you can write and what you can't. That was true at the Observer, and it's true at America.
And now you're at Kane University. You're working there at the John Kane Center for American History.
Yes, which is breaking news. We at Kane University just came into possession of the old Kane family estate. Now, the Kane family, of course, is Governor Tom Kane, and his family have been involved in New Jersey politics for a long time. Across the street from the university is their old homestead with a collection of manuscripts that we are describing, and I think rightfully so, as the last, or perhaps the last, unexplored treasure trove of manuscripts from the Revolutionary War. And I've been hired to sort of go through those manuscripts. We've already found a George Washington letter that has never been seen before.
Right, this was in the New York Times recently.
It was in the New York Times recently, right. It was a letter from Washington that was pasted into a scrapbook in 1826, mm-hmm. and there it remained.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very exciting project. I'm making the transition from journalism to academia. I'm in the PhD program at Rutgers University because, frankly, this is something I've been wanting to do for 20 years. And it is true, Tim, you'll find this out. When you get to be 50, all of a sudden you ask yourself certain questions, and sometimes you don't like the answers.
Right.
And my question when I was 50 was, do you think there'll still be newspaper readers when you're 70? And the answer, of course, was no. There'll be America readers, but perhaps not newspaper readers. But will there be college students? Ah, yes.
Yes.
So the future seemed to be on campus. So I've taken the chance to go back to graduate school at sort of midlife, and I do some teaching, and I'll be working with these manuscript collections. I may be working with this manuscript collection for the next 20 years.
Well, that's very exciting. And you continue to write for America Magazine, and your last column in the June 4th, 11th issue is on the Irish question and the peace process in Northern Ireland. And it's very exciting what's going on up there right now.
It is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wanted to write this column, because it's a little personal, and I sort of am ambivalent about personal first-person columns, but I thought I became interested in the Northern Ireland situation because of a priest, Father Morris Burke, who was my parish priest. We talked about it when I was writing a story that I knew nothing about Ireland. I was writing a story for the Staten Island Advance in 1979. And it turned out he was the chaplain for Irish Northern Aid, which was an IRA front, basically.
Wow.
So he obviously had a strong opinion. But, you know, what he told me was that this was an issue that was quite like the African-American struggle for civil rights in the 1960s. That's how it was for Catholics in Northern Ireland in the 70s. And that struck me, that issue of social justice and civil rights sort of struck me because I had grown up in the 1960s. So I became interested in the issue. I have been interested in the issue ever since. And now we're on the eve of something that I would have never thought could happen, certainly not in my lifetime, which is a power-sharing government led by Ian Paisley, sort of the arch enemy of many Catholic nationalists in Northern Ireland, and his deputy is a former IRA commander named Martin McGuinness. So I thought that even though America has covered this issue very well, I thought I would bring a little personal perspective. Just as somebody who has covered this for 30 years, I've been to Belfast, and to see it come to this is just wonderful, and I hope our readers will agree.
Now, you've written a couple of books about the Irish Troubles.
Yes, I have. In fact, my most recent venture in that field was a book called For the Cause of Liberty, which was a history of Irish nationalism as seen through people, a sort of series of narrative biographies. And many people came. It was published in 2000, which was after the Good Friday Agreement. So many people came to me and said, well, you know, there are a million books about Irish nationalism and Irish history. What makes yours different? I said, mine is the first to have a happy ending. And it was. I mean, it ended with the peace process. It ended with Bill Clinton going over to Belfast to accept the gratitude of Northern Ireland for his role in bringing about that process. So it did have a happy ending. And the amazing thing is, it's only gotten happier ever since, which really, you know, when you're worried about the troubles in the world today, and God knows there are many of them, I mean, if you look to Northern Ireland, you can honestly say, well, there's something that works, and maybe there is hope after all.
And that's part of what you call your trilogy on the Irish history?
Yes, well, I've written two other books. The Irish in America, which was a companion book to the PBS series of the same name, which came out in 1997. And I wrote a book about a very sort of unknown Irish journalist by the name of John Devoy. That book was called Irish Rebel. He was sort of the main Irish nationalist in New York from the late 19th century into the 20th century.
Okay. And your latest book, maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. The well-known historian Robert Dalek agreed to collaborate with me on a book about John F. Kennedy's speeches. Now, there again, you say, okay, well, what makes your book different from the 17,000 other books about John F. Kennedy? What made our book different is that we have looked at Kennedy's presidency just through his speeches. The book is called Let Every Nation Know. And what we did was we identified 31 of Kennedy's speeches in chronological order, which we thought told the story of John Kennedy's presidency in a way that no one else had told it. And sure enough, several reviewers actually said that, and I was delighted to see that, because he was an amazing speaker. He understood the power of the written word and the spoken word in a way that we've not seen other than, say, Ronald Reagan, who clearly understood it too. But it is amazing, too, to think about the times in which he lived. I mean, he was dealing with a hot, cold war. He was dealing with a social revolution in the South. And, you know, there were occasions during his presidency when he was going on national television multiple times during the course of a month, in addition to having a weekly press conference on television. I mean, it was the first reality show. A lot of people thought he was crazy. But he went on television every week and held a nationally televised press conference where no holds barred, you know, give and take, really wonderful to listen to. And, you know, regardless of your politics, I think if you read this book, you come away saying, regardless of how you felt about John Kennedy or how you feel about George W. Bush or even Bill Clinton, you come away saying, you know what, our leaders don't talk to us like that anymore for whatever reason, but they don't. And John Kennedy did.
And the name of that book again is?
Let Every Nation Know. So it's a line from his inaugural speech.
Okay, and that's published by?
It is published by Sourcebooks.
Okay, great. Well, maybe we can have you again when you have your next book out.
Well, okay. Let's see. What time is it?
Well, Terry Galway, thanks again for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
This is the Of Many Things column for July 2nd through 9th by Dennis M. Linehan, S.J. Just as this time of the year involves picnics and beaches, so May seems to be the time for installations and things. Things like graduations, first communions, confirmations, even retirements. All of these things figured in my family's doings this year. Being part of these celebrations provided a welcome respite from the stream of bad news globally. Two of them stand out in my mind and memory because of what they evoked. The first was at St. Gabriel's Church in Riverdale, in New York City's borough of the Bronx. I had been there before, often, since confirmation comes sometime after baptism and First Communion. This time, Michael Eugene Patrick McSweeney was being confirmed with his school class of 30. The proceedings were conducted with the precision of a 1950s May procession, but with none of the attendant anxiety of those days. The whole mood was the perfect mixture of seriousness and joy, in no little part thanks to the celebrant, Bishop Dominic Lagonegro, a fellow seminarian of the pastor, Monsignor Thomas Kelly. The bishop's personality is as expansive as his piety is genuine. It was clear that he considered this day to be as much a big deal as the kids did. All elements of the liturgies for both sacraments were conducted with care and very engaged empathy with each student. Afterward, the bishop was in no rush and sat for pictures for an hour. Little brother Liam Dennis McSweeney can be seen in one holding the crozier like a hurler. This confirmation took place during a regular Saturday evening mass, and the influx of admiring relatives and more than the usual length seemed not to disturb the parishioners. Quite the opposite. Most of them stayed on for the reception. Many of those who spoke to me bragged, I have to call it that, about the parish, the school, the pastor, and the principal. This came as no surprise. The principal, Deborah Petula, had told a similar crowd at a kindergarten graduation some years ago, "We believe that our most important task is handing on our faith." It used to be said with respect that this or that religious was a living rule, meaning that if the rule of the order were to be lost, it could be rewritten by observing that man or woman. I'd have to assert that St. Gabriel's is a living parish. On to the next day for some native air in the Philadelphia suburbs. This time, the occasion was a baptism for Hayden Pedro Kelly, in from Chicago with his entourage, to be greeted by an even larger local one, members of St. Philip Neri Parish in Lafayette Hill, Montgomery County. There we were welcomed by Monsignor Charles Vance, who might have been a clone of Monsignor Thomas Kelly in his graciousness and efficiency, and in his pride in his own living parish, and delight in his parishioners. It is no secret that the feeling is mutual. My brother and sister-in-law were the godparents and assumed the obligation of looking after older brother Declan Pablo Kelly during the proceedings. Then we all repaired to an inn, also named Lafayette, where our server's name was Kelly. After a weekend of enough religion to last until Labor Day, as someone said, I was taken to ponder the words of Deborah Petula at the graduation, that our task is handing on our faith, and to reflect on the role of the two exemplary pastors I'd been with. As in all cases, grace builds on nature, and I thought of the vocation and formation of both men, St. Joseph's Seminary, Dunwoody, New York, for Tom Kelly, and St. Charles Seminary, Overbrook, Pennsylvania, for Charlie Vance. War stories about both places are common clerical currency, perhaps especially among the most faithful alumni. They and their classmates were formed in an atmosphere of intellectual rigor and love for the church. Not for the church as an abstract concept, but for the church of the people whom they were preparing to serve. Now, as they perform the service for which they were prepared, their inborn courtesy and humility have led them to gather around them willing and enthusiastic partners in the task of handing on our faith. Both parishes have vibrant schools and religious education programs. Parishioners are active in the ministries, and they have a palpable sense of ownership in the community. I thought of the 1950s May processions, when the church seemed powerful, even though it was, in some places, glacial and remote. And I decided that I liked this incarnation more, with thanks to Tom, Charlie, and all like them, who labor in the vineyard to hand on our faith. Dennis M. Linehan, S.J. Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. We'd like to thank Jeremy Zippel, who provided the music for this week's podcast, from a concert recorded on December 3rd, 2006 at Fordham University Chapel on the occasion of the closing of the Jesuit Jubilee year. Tune in next week for an interview with Father Drew Christensen, who will be speaking about his article, Benedict as Peacemaker. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.